This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last year, after nearly 3 years of study, the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy released its comprehensive Ocean Blueprint for the 21st Century. That was a sweeping set of over 200 recommendations for establishing a new national ocean policy. President Bush responded to the Commission's recommendations with his U.S. Ocean Action Plan, released last December. The president's plan embraced many of the recommendations of the commission, and it seemed to be a promising first step toward overhauling ocean policy. Of course, talk is cheap, because last month when the president released his fiscal year 2006 budget, included in that budget, or more accurately, not included in the budget, is money to enact the plan. One example among many, a proposed 38% cut to the budget of the National Ocean Service. And there are other cuts that we're going to be getting into, because joining me now to talk more about what the president's 2006 budget might mean for ocean research is my first guest, Admiral Richard West, a retired Navy oceanographer and cartographer. He's now the president and CEO of the Consortium for Oceanographic Research and Education in Washington. He's on the line. Welcome to Science Friday, Admiral West.
Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. You wrote a letter to the president called A Teddy Roosevelt for Our Oceans. America Needs an Ocean Champion. Roger Ruffa, Vice Admiral of the U.S. Coast Guard, wrote that letter.
That's correct.
But I'm sure you have the same sentiments that he does.
I do, and I agree with Roger, and know Roger very well. It's an opportunity for the president to step up to the plate and take care of business. We've had two very good reports tell us over the last year and a half that our oceans are in trouble, and it's time for us to do something about it.
But it seemed, as I was saying before, didn't it seem like the president, when he issued his Ocean Action Plan, it looked pretty good?
Yeah, it was a thoughtful response to the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy. He delivered it in December, and it was obviously well thought out and responded to the major recommendations of the Ocean Commission. However, as you pointed out in your preliminary, we need money.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the cuts, I'm surprised reading the cuts, where the money is being cut. And even in the president's brother's, Jeb Bush's state, Florida is going to see a lot of budgetary cuts. I was reading from the Florida Museum of Natural History. It says that the National Marine Sanctuary Program lost $15 million, down 30%. The Florida Keys National Marine, you know, where we talk about watching the Everglades and things like that, they're all going to be cut?
Well, yeah, that's a concern, obviously, yeah, that the ocean agencies that do fund our research and understanding of our oceans are being cut. I mean, the NOAA is a primary ocean federal agency we have, and within NOAA, the National Ocean Service has most of the efforts and research and operations for oceans, mm-hmm. and they have historically taken some cuts. In fact, this the 06 budget this year, NOAA is down about $300 million over their appropriated amount from 05.
But you have other, there are what, 15 federal agencies that have different parts?
Right. One of the challenges we have in understanding and investing in our oceans are there are 15 federal agencies that do have an interest and a say in what happens with our oceans. That's one of the reasons why we've established the National Ocean Partnership Act in 96 that brought them together. But historically, the four largest federal agencies that fund our ocean research are the Navy, NOAA, NASA, and NSF. And so we kind of track their budgets investment in the ocean as a test of where we are.
Mm-hmm. What else took a hit? A lot of education and outreach programs.
Well, education outreach has turned out to be one of the sleeping recommendations that came out of the U.S. Ocean Commission. As you reminded the listeners, there were over 200 recommendations of the commission. I think the bottom line, if you could summarize them all, it was in the statement by the chairman, Admiral Watkins, when he said our oceans are in trouble. And one of the reasons our oceans are in trouble is most Americans don't appreciate nor do they understand the role of our oceans in our everyday life. So ocean education is extremely important. NSF has taken some cuts in education. NOAA historically has not been authorized to have ocean education programs, which we feel is very, very important, and hopefully that will come out in the next year's budget.
Mm-hmm. What about the Ocean Conservatories Initiative? That's not been funded, has it?
I'm not familiar with that program, Ira.
What other? The U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy recommended creating a $4 billion trust fund.
Right.
Has that come to pass?
No, it has not. And, of course, they one of the mandates of the Ocean Commission was not to provide any unfunded recommendations, and their source of funds were the $3 to $4 billion it's taken from revenue out of gain from access to the seas.
Mm-hmm.
That's, of course, yet to be determined. As you said earlier, we do need to find the funds to do these recommendations.
A lot of people don't realize that there's a whole fleet of ocean-going research vessels out there.
Yes, we have roughly there's around 27 research vessels that do our ocean research and take our students to sea and produce the next generation of scientists, as well as trying to understand our oceans. It's becoming a very aged fleet. As a matter of fact, about a third of them are going to go past their useful life here in the next 5 years, and we're very, very concerned because the three federal agencies that usually invest in those are not replacing them right now, and so that fleet is in trouble.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. So is there any way that Congress might, you know, step in here and earmark some of these things and bring them back?
Well, earmark is a is a challenging word, but yes, we do think there's a lot of interest in Washington to do something about our oceans, and the budget's been submitted, and we expect Congress to step up to the plate. There is a lot of interest in what the commission has reported to them, and we expect them to make some ads and some directions to take care of some of these recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Ocean observatories, something
yes.
close to your heart.
Yeah, the Ocean Observatories Initiative, Project Office Orion, funded by the National Science Foundation, is a great program for the future. It's the new technology of how to go and understand our oceans. It's cabled networks on the bottom of the oceans that can carry lots of data, real-time data, constant data over periods of time that will really let us understand our oceans, something we have not had in the past.
Mm-hmm. So do we think that, is there anybody, a champion in Congress or the Senate, who agrees with this thought, you know, that we need to put more money in the oceans?
Well, I think there's many, many folks in Congress that understand and appreciate our need to invest in our oceans. This is a very difficult time, as most people know. There's very little discretionary funds with what's going on right now. But we're confident that with the recommendations of the two commissions and the positive response from the president, that we will get some additional funding this year.
Yeah, we had committee chairman Sherwood Bollard on the program.
Right.
Talking about another part, you know, a lot of science being cut, space science. This was the Hubble Space Telescope. He didn't sound too hopeful about bringing money into that project. Once again, he's quoted as not being very, you know, hopeful about getting everything you want. I mean, no one wants everything, I don't think.
No, I have a lot of respect for Congressman Bowen and his chairmanship of the Science Committee, and he's right in the middle of the champion for us to get investment in our science. Not only just in, you know, the Hubble and into the oceans, but general investment in the science for the future of this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we don't know where this is going to wind up, because the president just proposes things, and as we know from the history of taxes, the Congress can do whatever it wants with a proposal. We don't know how it'll wind up.
Well, that's true. We're positive that something's going to be added over on the Hill this year and into the 06 budget, with a significant improvement in the 07 budget.
Mm-hmm. At least if I can get a call, and 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones here, and let's go to Jim in Anchorage, Alaska. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I've read a little bit about this project. It seems like it's a stealth project to allow permitting of giant mobile fish farms, which will have exotic escapees, spread disease and pollution on a vast scale in the without the possibility of any local oversight or control. That's what they call streamlining the permit process.
So you think this is a sneaky way to get big business farming the oceans?
Yeah, they're giving the public property to private individuals who can then show a vast personal profit while throwing all the waste onto the public resource, the ocean, which ultimately we all depend upon. But in the short term, there's a lot of money to be made if someone steals that property.
Any comment, Admiral?
See, I'm not quite sure that that's the purpose and the goal of the Ocean Commission. I think it was completely the opposite, to bring some governance and some insight into what's going on with our oceans, so we, in fact, can put the what the public wants to be done with our oceans. So I don't quite agree with the caller.
Well, I think the purpose of streamlining the permit process is to prevent any democratic oversight, and because there's only one place, one-stop shopping for permits, and the fix is in. So there's, and once you have the permit, it's a property right, and it can't be taken back. That's the idea of this system. It's been used.
All right, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Sure.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. There's got to be some positive stuff in the president's proposal, is there not?
Oh, I absolutely. As I mm-hmm. said, I thought it was a very well thought out, and the encouraged and the recommendations of the commission. An ocean observing system is absolutely crucial to the future. Mm-hmm. Increasing ocean education and outreach so the population understands the important role the oceans have. The big driver of our weather is the oceans. So how
can you account for the proposed budget, which doesn't fund these things?
Well, in defense of the federal agencies, they didn't have the report when they actually formulated their 06 budget because it was, in fact, submitted last fall. Mm-hmm. However, they did have some preliminary results, so they're not completely off the hook. But in their defense, they did not have the full report, nor did they have the president's response. They do have it now. That's why we expect Congress to help out in meeting these requirements. But they certainly have the direction and recommendations for the next year's budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll keep watching it, and we'll get back to you when we hear more about what's happening.
Glad to do that for you.
Thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Anytime, Ira.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too.
Admiral Richard West retired from the U.S. Navy, where he served as an oceanographer and cartographer, and he is president and CEO of the Consortium for Oceanographic Research and Education. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about some interesting new hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean. They're not these big black smokers, you know, the kind that we've seen in the last decade or so. There's something new. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're talking about the oceans. You know, it's been said many, many times, and more recently, you can say it's the rings of Saturn, the back of the moon, anywhere out in our solar system. We probably know more about some of these places we're visiting than the bottom of the oceans and some of the really deep places. And every time we hear about a new discovery, usually by accident, it drives that point home. So, you know, who would have ever thought that deep below the sea we would find hydrothermal vents, really hot water, black smokers thousands of feet below, until Robert Ballard and his team discovered them by accident in 1979. And feeding off the cooling magma beneath ocean ridges were whole communities of never-before-seen creatures, these giant tube worms and clams. And now this week, writing in the journal Science, researchers report on the discovery of an entirely new type of ecosystem, a new community on the ocean floor. It's called the Lost City Hydrothermal Field. Joining me now to talk more about it is Deborah Kelly, associate professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. She joins us from member station KUOW. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Kelly.
Thanks for inviting me.
So why'd you call it the Lost City?
The hydrothermal field or hot spring system sits on a very large mountain that's called the Atlantis Massif. Massif's just another word for mountain. And it's bounded by a very large fault system, kind of like the San Andreas, that's also called the Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And we were on the ship called the Atlantis, so it seemed to make sense at the time.
And where exactly is it located?
It's almost dead center of the Atlantic Ocean, about 5 days steam east of Bermuda.
Wow. So it's really right where the ocean is spreading apart, and then down that seam there?
Yes, it's almost there. One thing that's novel about this place is before, when most researchers go to look for these very high temperature vents that are associated with cooling volcanoes, that's where we normally go because we know there's fluids coming out of the seafloor there. And this mountain is actually quite a ways away from that area, so it's another novel aspect about the discovery.
And it's not one of these giant hot black pipe smokers that we normally associate with these vents, is it?
No, the normal hot springs, the black smokers, get up to about 400 degrees C or 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And unlike that, these the Lost City structures are kind of moderate temperatures, up to about 90 degrees C.
Mm-hmm. So do we see the giant tube worms and clams and things that we would see at the black smokers here, or are they a whole different kind of population?
No, the field hosts very novel organisms, everything from very small microorganisms that are a micron in size to the larger animals at Lost City. One of the surprising finds was that the larger animals are actually less than an inch or centimeters in size.
Hmm.
And there are very diverse new species of organisms that we find there.
Oh, really? So it's really just discovering something we've never seen before.
Right, and actually wasn't really predicted. And part of the reason for our excitement there is that the fluids, because the system isn't driven by cooling volcanoes, the fluid chemistry is very different. So it has properties similar to liquid Drano. And yet these microorganisms, yeah.
They're living in liquid Drano and they can survive?
Right, yes. Yes, warm liquid Drano, which makes it even worse.
Wow.
And they've figured out ways to utilize gases such as natural gas, methane, and hydrogen as their energy.
Well, you know, you hear about these. There's hope for life out in the solar system, I'm sure, when you hear that they're living in liquid Drano and things like that. That's one of the good reasons why you want to look for this sort of stuff, isn't it?
That's completely true. I think it really highlights that, you know, the ocean's a big place and there's a lot of opportunities for profound discoveries to be made still.
I want to bring in Cindy Lee Vandover. She's Associate Professor of Biology at the College of William and Mary and author of The Ecology of Deep Sea Hydrothermal Vents. She's also probably, she joins us by phone. Let me just first say welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you hold the record for being the captain of the Alvin?
No. What record?
I know. For how many times, how long you were down there?
Absolutely not. No, there's many people who have done more dives, many, many more dives than me.
But you've been down there quite a while.
I try to go lots of times and all over the world.
And where is your next trip? I understand you have a new trip going up?
Yes, I fly out on Wednesday to, I go out of Tahiti, but we steam down to 38 degrees latitude south, which will take Alvin down. I'm pretty sure that's the farthest south she's ever been in her life, getting her down into those southern waters in the Pacific.
Now, will you be piloting the Alvin?
No, I'm a retired pilot.
You're retired.
Now. Yeah, no, I'll just be an observer in the boat.
And when we were talking to Dr. Kelly, you know, and I know even with Bob Ballard, these things are surprising discoveries that you make. You really don't know what you're going to find when you go on dives like these.
Absolutely true. You know, I just went to see the IMAX movie that stars this Lost City site that Deb found.
Yeah.
And I watched that and I thought, this is as good as being there, except you can't, there's none of the excitement of what's just beyond the lights. Because you're sitting in a movie theater, you know what's beyond the lights.
Right.
But when you're in the submarine, it's wide open. You just don't know what's going to be there.
And are you looking for something specifically on this dive?
We do know there are hydrothermal vents in the specific area where we're going. The Germans discovered the site a couple years ago, but they were looking with cameras. And so we're going to go in and look at it closely, do some careful sampling so that we can look at the biology, the types of species there. The exciting thing is we think we might be finding some of the species we already know well from the Western Pacific and find them for the first time in the Eastern Pacific. And so it's working on this puzzle of what species are where.
So you're not going to an unknown, type of area?
It's pretty much unknown. Somebody's been there before with a camera, but
right.
You know, you can imagine dangling a camera from a long string.
Right.
It's the same as being there.
Mm-hmm. Would you be surprised to find hot hydrothermal vents and other things down there?
Oh, we definitely know they're hydrothermal vents, and we're certain to find new species as well. That's the way it goes.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. A lot of people want to talk about this. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in. Let's go to Steve in York City, South Carolina. York County, South Carolina. Hi, Steve.
Hi
there.
I was curious. I had heard something recently about the currents in the Atlantic Ocean that carry, I guess, hot water from the equator up the coast of North America and then cool up in the Arctic and then flow back over. And it's supposed to be a really important, I guess, clockwise current flow of the Atlantic that has a lot to do with our weather. And it's supposed to be being altered by large amounts of fresh water melting off of the North Pole. And I was curious if y'all had heard the latest on that and how the potential effects on our weather patterns.
Do you care to comment? Cindy, Debbie, anybody? Or is that out of your ballpark?
I'm in the wrong ocean.
That's a global warming question, and they're deep sea divers.
That's right.
Okay. Sorry, I just I just read something about this, and I didn't catch the whole story. So
okay, we'll cover it. We've covered it before. We'll cover it again. So stay tuned, as they say. Thanks for calling, Steve.
Bye bye.
Can you imagine anything different, Dr. Kelly, that you might find down there? That I know we were talking about how things are surprising. Well, they would have to be surprising, right? I mean, you don't know what you're going to see all the time. You can go down expecting something, but then you have to be surprised if you're going to find something new.
Right. I think, we all, for those of us who have been working in one place for a long time, we sort of have expectations. And I think what discoveries like this do is they really highlight that you have to keep your thoughts open and really be creative about where you think life can live. And certainly this this discovery highlights that.
Cindy, how many years does the Alvin have left of useful life?
Well, she's over 40 now, and she's still working hard. But the good news is we have a replacement submersible coming online, and we're hoping she'll be finished in 2008.
What do you mean you're hoping?
Well, the commitment's been made to do the first phase of the construction, which is the personnel sphere, the titanium sphere that the people climb into. It's a three-person submersible. But that needs to be successfully completed. There's some challenging aspects of that in terms of the engineering, but we're optimistic that'll get done. And then there'll be a second phase that builds the rest of the structure and really puts the sub together so that it looks like the kind of vehicle we all know and love is Alvin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that is scheduled for 2008. But if everything depends on the budgets. We don't have crystal balls and can't see what's going to happen in this federal budget process that far down the road.
Yeah, we were just talking about that earlier. You can't put the Alvin out there by itself. A ship has to carry it, right?
That's right.
You have to have money for those ships to go someplace.
Exactly. Yeah, she has her own mothership, and in fact, she's being built so that she can work on the same mothership, so we don't have to have a brand new ship to operate the replacement vehicle.
How is this going to be different than your 40-year-old Alvin?
Well, she's going to be totally different. She's going to have much better visibility, which is if you're going in the submarine to be able to see in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to dive deeper. Right now, Alvin goes to 4,500 meters, and the new the replacement vehicle is going to go to 6,500 meters. That opens up a huge amount of seafloor. Alvin right now can only see about something on the order of 60% of the seafloor, and the new sub will cover almost 99%. It just can't get into the very deepest trenches.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kelly, why do you think that the life at these vents the ecosystem is so much different than at the hot smokers?
I think in part because the actual heat that's being mined to drive the hydrothermal flow, the fluid circulation, is from interaction of seawater with these rocks that were once formed deep beneath Earth's crust. And as a result of that, the fluid chemistry is, instead of being acidic, which is the black smoker system that has a lot of carbon dioxide from volcanic gases, these microorganisms and the macrofauna have had to adapt to, again, very high pH alkaline environment, similar to Drano, and that the fluids are very rich in methane and hydrogen. So the very nutrient sources and energy sources that most organisms live on in a black smoker system aren't, they're very different than in the Lost City system.
So you don't see the lush community that you would see at the black smokers?
No, but we do see, for one thing, the organisms, things like tube worms, the things that Cindy studies in detail, they really aren't present on the Atlantic. So there's a very different macrofaunal community or larger animals in black smokers in the Pacific than there are in the Atlantic anyway. But the larger animals at Lost City, for reasons we don't understand, aren't really large. They're very small, say a centimeter in size.
Mm-hmm. Is there more bacteria there than there would be out at the black smokers?
Again, there in terms of numbers, they're very, very dense communities. The total numbers are similar to what lives inside the black smoker chimneys, but the diversity in the microorganisms at Lost City is very low, and we're not quite sure if it has something to do with the gases that they're living off of.
Is it this archetype also?
Archaea that are there, and that's one of the organisms that the microbiologists are extremely excited about. because they do live on methane and hydrogen. Mm-hmm. One of the implications is if you want to look for life on other planets or in early Earth, the rocks that lie beneath Lost City are very similar to early Earth rocks. And so we have hope that by looking at the Lost City, we can understand more about how life evolved on the planet and where to go elsewhere in the solar system.
Talking about life in the oceans this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, let's go to Elizabeth in San Jose.
Hi there.
Hi there.
First, I have to say hi to Cindy. She may not remember me, but I did my PhD on deep sea vents, and we were on a couple cruises together.
Hello.
Hi there. Well, you answered one of my questions about the composition of the Drano, because I haven't read the article yet. And so, but I got that. And how did you guys figure this out that these guys might be there?
The Lost City field?
Yeah.
It was completely by accident. It was on a cruise funded by the National Science Foundation to look at this very large mountain, which is sort of a common feature, particularly in the Atlantic Oceans. And we had an Alvin dive program that would work during the day, and at night we towed a camera around to get images of the mountain, and just stumbled across a thing, right place, right time.
So you found it using the camera?
We first found it using the camera, and then Jeff Carson and myself had the opportunity to dive 2 days later. We only had the one dive, which was just the tiniest glimpse into the system, and then NSF funded us to go back in 2003.
Well, that's completely great, and I guess my comment would be to just remind people how completely important this is for understanding not just the ocean, but life on other planets. I'm really glad you guys are emphasizing that. Thanks for the great work.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I noticed in the article in the paper, it shows a little cross-section of the area and says that these are these carbonate chimneys that they're called. They're up to 60 meters tall, almost 200 feet tall.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow.
So we have reason to believe from initial dating that this system has been active for at least 30,000 years and probably quite a bit longer than that. So they have once they get started, they have a long time to grow.
So they're like stalactites growing up from the ocean floor.
Exactly. Yep. Same material, limestone.
Wow. What do you say when you see this? I mean, can you quote that on the air, what you say?
No. There was an amazing amount of excitement. And I think we were so anxious to do everything we could the first dive and collect samples. And it's very challenging because you don't even have a map of the place. We don't have... Much of the ocean isn't mapped in detail enough to see these structures. So in Alvin, the lights don't go very far in seawater, and you're wandering around, coming up on these things that are the size of sequoias or, looked like a redwood forest, only they were chimneys. And so we were laughing and joking and, just a lot of excitement.
Wow. Dr. Vandover, you've been down there many times. Do you have a favorite moment, an exciting moment, or something that, sticks out more in your mind than any other?
Oh, gosh, I don't think any one particular time. I think being able to sit in front of a black smoker is just one of the most astounding things and a privilege to do. It's just unbelievable to watch this water belch out of the seafloor and then see the animals around it, particularly the swarming shrimp. So, in fact, I guess the first time I saw the swarming shrimp in the Atlantic, that was pretty fantastic. That really was. Your jaw drops. It does. Even when you've seen it on video, know they're there, and you get up close and you look. It's like, oh, my God, what are these things doing there?
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Doyle in Panama City. Hi, Doyle.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I was wondering, with all the advances that have been made with remotely operated vehicles and unmanned systems, what particular advantages you get from a manned submersible in terms of doing the research?
Yeah, there is that debate whether, there are the manned, just like out in outer space, the manned or the people and the robotic ones.
You want me to have a go at that?
Go ahead.
Well, there's one of the things we find when people who've only watched video of the seafloor finally get down in the submarine, they get down there and it all clicks. It all comes together. It's like, oh, that's what it's like. So it's this, you can watch all the video you want. Until you see it, your brain doesn't put it together the way it really is, the three-dimensional aspect, the size, the scale. I know it's hard to believe, but
But trust me, I mean, it's like this. And I've done it even having been in the submarine so often. I was just visiting a lab in France and had a very difficult time interpreting the video. But had I been in the submarine, I would have known what was going on.
I get you. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about the oceans, take your questions, and try to figure out what it's like to sit in front of a black smoker watching it. Just unfathomable. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the oceans and life under deep under the sea with my guests. Cindy Lee Vandover is Associate Professor of Biology at the College of William and Mary in Virginia. Deborah Kelly, Associate Professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. You know, when you dive off a dock into the ocean, the pressure underwater pushes on your eardrums. You know, you just have to go down 5 or 10 feet, and it can become uncomfortable or painful. Now, imagine diving down to over 8,000 feet, and you'll get a sense of the skull-crushing pressure in which some bacteria called piezophiles feel right at home. Researchers from Italy and California collaborated to sequence the genome of one of these bacteria and are just starting to learn what special adaptions allow them to thrive in the deep sea. What can we learn from the genes of these extreme bacteria? How might this knowledge be applied to the search for life on other planets? Always asking those questions about those things, and we're going to put those questions to Douglas Bartlett, Professor of Marine Biology at the University of California Scripp Institution of Oceanography. He joins us today by phone from La Jolla. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Bartlett.
Hi, Ira. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you. Tell us about the study. What exactly did you do here?
We have been working with a variety of deep-sea microorganisms, and we took one that is fairly easy to manipulate in the laboratory, and with some wonderful people in Italy, we sequenced its genome, and we characterized its genes, and we looked at how those genes are activated as a function of pressure.
And you mean the pressure actually activates the genes?
These organisms have the ability to sense changes in hydrostatic pressure. They live in a world that is physically very different from the skin of the planet in which we humans reside. They live in a world where temperature, for the most part, doesn't vary very much, but pressure as they move up and down in the water column can. And they sense that pressure. And when we looked at the genes present in this deep-sea microorganism, we found that many of them respond to changes in hydrostatic pressure.
How do you get a gene to respond to pressure?
Well, that's a great question. We don't really know yet how this sensory transduction works. It looks like there's a protein stuck in the membrane that gets squeezed when the cells experience higher pressure, and that triggers a signal transduction event that activates the expression of genes that help the cells to adapt to the increased pressure.
But it must have a little pressure meter built in to know, you know.
It does. So these cells have a barometer, or I guess we would call it a piezometer, inside them.
That's just so fascinating. You know, piezo means what? Pressure or crunching, crushing or something like that?
Piezo is Greek for pressure. Right.
Because we have crystals we call piezoelectric. When you apply pressure to the crystal, it gives off a little voltage or something like that.
Right.
So when you apply pressure to this bacterium, its genes sense it.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. These organisms have evolved in an environment where pressure is a very important selective environment, and it's influenced the evolution and the distribution of life in the deep ocean.
All right. So if you sequence the gene, what can you learn from it?
Well, we learn some basic research applications and some applied potential. The basic research is now that we have a blueprint for a life form which inhabits the cold, deep ocean, and we've got a list of about 6,000 genes, now we and others can further study those genes, for example, to see which of them are truly critical to existence in the benthos. And in the future, we will be able to compare this blueprint with others for other deep-sea life and thereby better discern which genes or gene characteristics are universally required for life at depth.
Now let's talk about how much pressure there is down there. Up here at sea level, it's about 15 pounds per square inch.
That's right.
Down there, it's...
Well, where our organism was isolated from, it's about 4,000 pounds per square inch, and in the deepest trenches, it's about 15,000 pounds per square inch.
Do you have any reason to doubt that you might find that kind of life down there, 15,000 pounds per square inch?
At one time in our history, people wondered if there was life in the deep ocean. Now we know that there is, and some very skillful and brilliant deep sea biologists have recovered a variety of life forms, even from the Marianas Trench. So we know that pressure, at least going up to 15,000 pounds per square inch, does not preclude the existence of life.
We've been talking with other scientists, Cindy Lee Vandover and Deborah Kelly, talking about the implications of this, and I always try to relate it to finding life on other planets. Would this also have a use for determining the viability of maybe some bacteria like these on other planets?
Well, the genome sequence doesn't tell us anything about that, but the very nature of these microbes might. That is, these are organisms that can live at a close to a freezing temperature and at these incredibly high pressures. These days, astrobiologists are very interested in the other oceanic environment in our solar system, Jupiter's moon Europa. And in that liquid ocean environment, taking into account the surface gravity of the planets and the depth of that icy layer, the watery world should exist at very high pressures, maybe 30,000 pounds per square inch or greater. And just based on what's been studied in the deep ocean environments here on Earth, there's no reason to think that life couldn't exist at those temperatures and pressures that exist in Europa's ocean. And whatever future intrepid space explorers go out there to collect samples, they better bring their pressure vessels with them because they're going to need to keep those samples cold and at high pressure to keep them alive.
Yeah, we'll make sure they have them.
Okay.
Well, now I'm having too much fun. When one of the reasons for sequencing things is that you look for useful genes you might pluck out and grow someplace else or put them into other things. Did you find any of those useful genes in these?
Right. Well, so a lot of the genes have never been identified in any other organism. So there's a lot of unknowns there in the genome sequence. But there are genes for things that we already can tell may have some applied value. For example, this organism has genes for making omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, very good fatty acids for humans to get into their diet. They are good for our cardiovascular health. They help to prevent certain cancers. So if these genes could be plucked out and inserted into the genomes of some other organisms, and there are some companies that are interested in putting these kinds of genes into plants or perhaps into fermentative microbes that are used for food fermentation. So I think that's one possibility. Also, these organisms in the deep sea, they don't see a lot of nutrients, and those that come their way, they need to be able to take advantage of. And so they have lots of degradative enzymes. And some of those enzymes look like they could break down very complex polysaccharides and perhaps different kinds of hydrocarbons. And so for cleaning up certain environmental pollutants, some of these enzymes could have some value.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking about the oceans this hour. Dr. Kelly, interesting stuff. Deborah Kelly?
Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with these little bacteria?
I've read a little bit about the high pressure organisms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's not what you look for when you go on your dives. You're looking for different things.
No. In fact, one of the novel things about Lost City is it's actually at the other end member. It's actually quite shallow, only about 700 meters water depth, which is pretty. That's kind of the upper limit for some of the larger animals to live at that are associated with vents.
Dr. Bartlett, if you were to bring these up higher, would they still be able to survive and maybe that little pressure gauge that they have change and adapt their biology?
So the organism that we've been studying can adapt, and it can grow at atmospheric pressure, so we don't always have to have it in titanium or stainless steel pressure vessels. But a lot of the organisms in those really deep sea trenches can't survive. And so if they were brought up, especially if they were warmed, they would die. But even if they were kept cold, they would slowly lyse because they're just not able to adapt to that low a pressure.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Is it Amnon and McLean?
It's Eamon.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my question. Actually, you just kind of touched upon what I was going to ask about. Being that these organisms live in a very highly specific environment, I was just wondering if they could elaborate on the difficulties of culturing these organisms in the lab.
Good question, yeah.
Right. These organisms that we work with are difficult to manipulate because the culture tube you have to use for growing up these microbes is a pressure vessel. And so you're separated by an inch or so of stainless steel from the object that you'd like to study. So it is difficult. The organism we work with is one that can grow at both atmospheric pressure and at these higher pressures. That allows us to genetically manipulate it and then see what sort of changes we've made in terms of growth ability at high pressure. But yes, these are organisms that can be very difficult to work with.
Good question. Thanks for calling. Cindy, you must have a lot of experience bringing stuff to the surface.
Yeah.
You have to be very careful how you bring it up.
Yeah, when I work with the invertebrates, I confess, most of the animals I bring up, I apologize, but I have to kill them. And I don't do it lightly. But there are the physiologists who have gotten very good at bringing up the tube worms, keeping them alive. They bring them up cold. I know that sounds funny because we're talking about things that live in warm water, but it's best to keep them chilled in the cold deep sea water as they come to the surface and then bring them up and put them back into pressure chambers. And the scientists, the biologists have learned to keep them alive for extended periods of time to do experiments on. The things that don't survive on the way up and don't come up in good condition at all are the fish, because they have a gas volume and the pressure change, you know, the gas expands as the fish get brought up, and they don't look good when they come up.
You have a second trip coming up in May, do you not?
I do.
Tell us about that.
It's related to the first one. They're both funded by the National Science Foundation, and the second one's going to what we call back arc basins in Laos and Fiji basins in Fiji and Tonga waters, and we'll be looking at hydrothermal vents there. The Lao work is in collaboration with other scientists with the Ridge 2000 program, which is the oversight group that watches what we do on the mid-ocean ridges and helps organize things. So we'll be looking for the animals. Again, it's this comparison of what lives in the western Pacific at hot springs versus what we find in the eastern Pacific, and trying to figure out how they get from one place to another, or if they have.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the deep ocean this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Do you think there is a mingling that goes on?
Not on an ecological scale, maybe, mm-hmm. but certainly over time. There's the species seem to move island to island on the seafloor, but there's barriers. So sometimes the big fracture zones may serve as filters. Some species get across it, and others don't. And, you know, they're getting across it's their larval stages that are dispersing freely in the water column. And so understanding why one species can get across a barrier and another can't is going to help us understand mm-hmm. the larval strategies and how they do this, how they get mixed up throughout the ocean.
Matthew in Dannington, Pennsylvania. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Hey, I was curious if you're at any particular deep site on a regular basis enough to determine, does human pollution at the surface, does it show up in any of your tests? Do you check water quality and whatnot while you're down there?
Any of my guests, you can jump in.
This is Cindy. I did some work with, we were dumping sewage sludge off New Jersey in the late 1980s, and I worked.
You weren't dumping it. You say we
I
were.
I was not. Okay. We were the New Metropolitan New York, New Jersey, and I am from New Jersey, so in some mm-hmm. way I contributed probably.
Okay.
and the thought was that this stuff, the sewage sludge, would just get mixed in the surface and not really get to the bottom. But we were able to pick up animals from 2,000 meters water depth and find the signals from that sewage sludge there. So, yes, what we do on the surface waters and the coastline certainly gets down into deep sea, although I don't think we have any routine sampling monitoring programs, that I'm aware of. There might well be something going on. But
Douglas, you've seen anything really deep down there?
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with personal experiences going down into the deep ocean and seeing signs of human activity. But I have some friends in Japan who have. They have the Deep Star program in Japan, and lots of remote-operated vehicles and submersibles that they've used in the Japan Trench. And a colleague of mine told me of a story being down in the submersible at great depths and seeing this human torso coming up from the seafloor. And it turned out that it was a mannequin.
Oh.
Isn't that something? So more signs of human waste that have been dropped into the deep ocean.
I've seen that in Sphere or something. Wow, I'm glad you ended that way. Cindy, you see anything down there?
Oh, things I don't really like to admit to. There are beer cans. There's one place in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge where there's a toilet. I've seen trash bags, plastic bags filled with trash on the seafloor. It's pretty upsetting to see this stuff when you come across it.
And there's no oxygen down there, so they'll never biodegrade, right?
Oh, no, there's oxygen there.
Way down there at the bottom?
Yeah, and in most of the ocean basin, there's, mm-hmm. there's oxygen. Well, that's why the tube worms can live. They need not just the sulfite, they have to have oxygen.
So they take it out of the water.
Yep, out of the regular seawater. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What would really, I have about 30 seconds, what would really surprise you to see?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Trilobites. I want to see living trilobites on the seafloor. That would surprise me.
Wow. You think it's possible?
No.
No wonder you would really be sad. And Doug, what would really surprise you?
Oh, there is so much interest in looking at microbial diversity today. If there were discoveries that related to the evolution of life, ancient organisms that really went back several billion years, that would be very exciting.
Like another coelacanth sort of thing?
You know? Oh, I'm thinking of perhaps the branch point between the bacteria and the archaea, primitive prokaryotic simple organisms.
Mm-hmm. And Deborah Kelly?
I'd really be surprised to see an underwater eruption going on. The fact is we know they're going on all the time, but we've never really been to a volcano that's been erupting, and when they erupt, they produce new life associated with them.
Well, I wish you all good luck and hoping someday you'll get to see all of that stuff. Thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Cindy Lee Vandover and Deborah Kelly and Douglas Bartlett to talking about their research Below the Wave.